Hello, I'm Jane Crowther and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And thanks for taking out a subscription. We are so pleased that you did. And today I'm joined by our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello. And our editor at large, Jamie Graham.
Hello, Jane.
Hello, Jamie. So this week we are finding out if Cruella is the dog's bollocks, whether The Conjuring The Devil Made Me Do It is diabolical, if Drunk Bus is a tonic, if Surge is a powerful force, and whether First Cow moves us.
Oh, my God.
Do you like that?
Did you? How long did it take you to work on that one?
Well, I thought it was pretty good, actually. Not... No? Okay. Well, anyway.
It's all but... right.
Okay. Before we start on all of those, tell me what you've been watching this week. What have you been feasting your eyes on, Jack Shepherd? Not feasting your eyes on Jack Shepherd, though he does look charming today in a lumberjack fleece and tousled hair. But we're not feasting our eyes on him. What is he feasting his eyes on?
We got there in the end, didn't we? I've been watching all the movies that we're doing for this podcast. Plus, I've actually been watching the show Halston on Netflix.
Oh, yeah. Any good? I haven't seen it.
I love Ewan McGregor, and he's incredibly like hammy in it. And I find that a lot of fun. So, yeah, definitely enjoying that. I don't think it's definitely not for everyone. This is not my recommendation to everyone, unless you really like Ewan McGregor going all out. Also, he's serving some incredible looks. A lot of like cape wearing, a lot of good fashion going on in the show. So it's not a complete recommendation, but if you do enjoy Ewan McGregor, then it's definitely one to watch. How about you guys? What have you been feasting your eyes on?
Jamie, you've probably been doing something hideous and horror-y.
I have actually done a few horrors this week. I did a little horror film coming out called Werewolves Within, which comes out next month, which was a lot of fun, based on the multiplayer game, which I've never played in my life because I'm not a gamer, but the film's a lot of fun. And I went back to an old classic, which not many people know unless you're a real horror aficionado, called Lake Mungo.
Oh, yeah, Lake Mungo.
Yeah, came out in 2008, tiny little Australian kind of fake documentary about a girl who disappears. It was self-released in Australia in 2008 and then slipped out on DVD in various countries and kind of no one's really heard of it. And then it gradually built up a reputation with horror fans over the last 12 years. And it's one of my favourites of this century. And because it's about to come out on Blu-ray,
it is.
Big plug, second size of releasing it on Blu-ray. Fantastic disc with loads and loads and loads of extras. Because of that, and because I'm reviewing it, I went back and watched it again, first time for a few years, and it chilled me to the bone, and not many films do that. I watched it on my own, in the house on my own, late at night, and when it finished, I literally did not want to get up from the sofa and walk through the kitchen to the bathroom to have a wee, because I was too scared to pass the dark window, and I haven't had that for years. So that was a lot of fun. As well as being really scary, it's really moving and emotional as well, which makes it a great film. So look out for that, and if you haven't seen it, please do.
This has actually reminded me of what I actually did watch this week as well, which was the original Ring.
Have you never seen it?
It's always terrified me, the idea of watching it, so I finally decided to do it when I was at home alone.
Great. Good choice.
Yeah, it was great. I really loved it.
Yeah. Lake Mungo is quite similar to that in that it's very lo-fi, low-key chills and just sort of creeps up on you, very insidious. So if you want a lot of sort of teenagers being killed, it's not for you. But if you like sort of really slow, emotion-led horror, like, you know, something like Don't Look Now back in the day, then this is for you.
Not to be confused with Lake Placid, which when I think of Lake Mungo, I always think for a split second, is that the one, the sort of 90s? Yeah. No, that's Lake Placid. I always have that.
Which is also good.
Lake
Placid is a lot of fun. A snappy little movie.
It
70
is
minutes
snappy,
long.
Isn't it? So I've been watching things back in screenings this week. Ooh. I have been actually with other film critics in a room watching films. And one of the films we'll be discussing here, I saw in a beautiful theatre with the surround sound. And I was sat right at the back. And that whole concept of hearing stuff behind me and to the side of me and everything, I don't have a fancy setup at home, was a delight. So I have enjoyed watching things back on the big screen and with the surround sound. Delightful.
I did actually go to a cinema this week, not a screening, but I went to like normal public cinema, which I always prefer anyway. And I've totally forgotten what I saw. What
did you see, Peter?
Jane?
Was it Peter Rabbit?
What was it, darling? Oh, yes, I saw Taxi Driver. How could I forget that? Oh, my God.
Jamie.
Yes, I went, one of my favourite films of all time, top 10, and I forgot it. But, yeah, I went, and I don't think I've ever seen it on the big screen before, and just phenomenal. It was like watching it for the first time on the big screen. We have to go back to the cinemas. What an experience.
Absolutely. I'm going to see Peter Rabbit 2 this weekend. That's my cross to bear. Anyway, so as you can see, Jamie's brain is working excellently. He's in total critic form. He can't remember anything.
Exactly.
So let's see if he can remember what he watched this week. Shall we start with a Disney tale? But let's make it fashion, darling.
You won't admit you love me. And so, how
do you have a light?
To know you always tell me.
Get her.
This doesn't have to be a scene.
It really, really does.
Can I remind you all that I'm doing this in heels?
What was your name?
Cruella.
If you can't make your mind up, we'll never get started.
I want to make trouble. You in?
I do love trouble.
You have a bit of an extreme side.
Yes, darling.
What fun that is.
So this is Cruella, long awaited. What is it about, Jack? Obviously, it's connected to 101 Dalmatians, but how?
It's an origin story for Cruella de Vil, the infamous villain and so-called puppy killer. Here played by Emma Stone, and also not quite Cruella yet. She's known as Estella, and she's an orphan girl who dreams of becoming a fashion designer. And with her motley crew of misfits, Jasper and Horace, they steal Estella's way into the fashion house of the Baroness, which is run by Emma Thompson. Long story short, the Baroness and Estella have a history together, and the truth becomes known in a series of twists and turns that gradually show the evolution of Estella into the 101 Dalmatians villain. And yes, we do get the origins of where she gets the de Vil name.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the short version of, I would say, quite a long film.
Yes.
What did you guys think?
One thing that people sort of compared it to when the trailer first came out, the first one, was Joker. What do you reckon? Is it any way, shape or form like Joker?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it is, in terms of it's got a slightly sort of punkish, anarchic sensibility. It's set in the 70s. And once Emma Stone becomes Cruella, she sort of does go for it hell for leather, and she's a lot of fun. I kind of, when she was Estella at the start, for me, it wasn't really working. It was dragging. But once she cuts loose and she's got the hair and the fashion and the makeup, and she's rolling her eyes and doing all these dirty looks at people and being snide, then, yeah, you can sort of see the Joker comparison. But where it's not is it felt very much like a Disney movie, because it is a Disney movie, and it's sort of a little bit rough around the edges, and it's got that slightly anarchic feel. But being Disney, it doesn't go for it full out. It felt a little bit safe, a little bit mainstream. Whereas the Joker, whether you like it or loathe it, and I'm firmly in the light camp, it is full out disturbing, distressing. It takes a lot of chances. It took over $1 billion, which, if you actually consider just how alarming the film is and how disturbing it is quite remarkable. Whereas this, to me, felt like Disney trying to be a little bit anarchic, but not having the guts to go all out.
Jack, what did you think?
I agree with Jamie. I mean, the whole of Joker is very much about the final transformation into Joker, you know, the final moments. And the build up to that is incredibly tense and just very well done. And even though I'm not the biggest fan of that movie, I think it was supremely well done. And with this, the build up into Cruella and the Estella character just wasn't interesting enough. And I felt like it almost felt ham-fisted in the end. Like, you know, we need to become Cruella. We need her to say, oh, I'm no longer Estella or whatever. And it just, it didn't really work for me. And then also when she kind of becomes Cruella, I felt like the movie was going to end. And then I realized that I was only less than halfway through. So
It is quite long, isn't it? For
two and a quarter hours, isn't
for
it?
For a kid's film. So I found the pacing off, and it sort of roared along in some segments and was just poppy and visually exciting and amazing. And then sort of dipped in others. And it felt sort of very much like Cruella in this sort of split down the middle and his two kind of personalities. There seemed to be a film for adults happening and a film for kids happening and sort of smushed together. So it didn't quite feel like it was a whole. Having said that, though, it looked fantastic. And I got such a kick out of seeing women at the center of this story, just, you know, tearing strips off each other with perfectly applied eyeliner and a fabulous dress on. You know, at one point, Emma Stone's Cruella says, "I'd like everyone to know that I'm doing this in heels, darling." And, you know, I sort of enjoyed that sort of campy fabulousness of it. I wanted more of that, I think. And the sort of emotional arc that they were trying to go for in the end didn't really care about that so much as what will she wear next and how witheringly will she deliver a line.
Where it works best is there's about half an hour in the film where she's becoming Cruella and she's beginning to make a real sort of splash in the fashion scene. And she does that by she just keeps outwitting and kind of outmaneuvering the Baroness. And every time the Baroness is about to have a big public event and sort of get all the headlines, Cruella pops up and does some sort of almost like flash mob kind of activity.
Yeah. Where she a disruption.
A disruption to kind of upstage the Baroness. And these sequences are really inventive and fun. And, you know, it's directed by Craig Gillespie, who did I, Tonya. And you can kind of see his fingerprints on these bits. And for about half an hour when it was doing that, I loved it. You know, that was when it was at its best. But the other hour and three quarters of it, maybe not quite so much.
I was going to say very similar. You know, those moments, especially when you've got Thompson and Stone going head to head, were really electric and really fun. They went past so quickly. And, you know, you've got this like a prelude at the beginning with the young flashbacked Estella, and then that kind of forms the basis of the later twists and turns, which I won't go into here. But I found that the revelations of those fell quite flat for me.
And also, if you've read our cover feature, you probably guessed them, because there was a certain cast member that talked, I think, quite openly about his character arc that basically I was expecting the twist with that person throughout the film. So, yeah, I don't know that it was particularly as twisty as it thought it was. And also the other thing, this is, you know, not connected to character arcs or anything, but how long do they think a dog takes to poo? Because there's a whole sequence where they're waiting for a dog to poo something out and it takes days. Do Dalmatians hold on? I don't know. So I found myself thinking about that, which probably isn't what you should be thinking about when you're watching such a fabulous film.
For me, the thing that kind of sums up this film is the soundtrack. The soundtrack that they're releasing, I think there's about 24 songs on it. And it's kind of wall-to-wall bangers of the period, that it's like Stone Cold Crazy by Queen and Should I Stay or Should I Go with Clash and Time of the Season, The Zombies, These Boots Are Made for Walking,
Nancy Sinatra.
And it's all great, but even though it's great and a lot of fun, it's all the choices you kind of expect, but it's very, very mainstream and rather on the nose choices. And for me, that kind of sums up the film in a way that, you know, if it really wants to have that punky feeling to it, which it seems to be going for, then it should have gone a little bit left field and thrown in some surprises, whereas it felt to me a bit by committee. But it's like, well, this soundtrack will sell loads if we make sure we got these big, big hits in and everyone can tap along to it, you know?
Yeah. And also massive boost for Liberties. I mean, Liberties gets a huge role in the film and made me want to go and finger their scarves in their beautiful hall. Yeah, it's very London-y, isn't it? So it's very much a postcard to London. But that sort of movie version of London, very much, it's not dirty and gritty and punky. It's almost Poppins-esque in as much as, you know, Red Buses and Regent's Park. But the punk is coming from her. She does look fabulous, though. I mean,
she's great.
The outfits. If Jenny Bevan, who is, you know, legendary costume designer, doesn't get awards traction for these fabulous creations, I'd be very surprised. And even Emma Thompson as well, her outfits are just fabulous, aren't they? In a sort of Dior-esque 50s way.
Oh, it's stunning.
The whole thing is gorgeous. But yeah, I wonder how whether kids would get it or enjoy it.
I'm not sure kids will, whereas teenagers, I don't think it'll be quite out there enough for them. Like I said, it's a little bit safe. But you know, but having said that, it's okay, you know, and parts of it are very good, entertaining. I don't want to sound like I'm really, really down on it. To be reductive and put it in a star rating, for me, it's 3 stars. Mm. Good, solid 3 stars.
And it's certainly a film that would benefit from being seen on a big screen.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's very handsomely put together. What about Emma Stone then? When I talked to the cast, they were talking about her as this is a role that will, you know, redefine her career and will probably have her in the awards conversation. Do we think that's true?
Probably not. It was almost the performance I expected of her to give as Cruella. She has these like fabulous moments. I think my slight issue is that, you know, we all know Cruella as this great villain, and I never quite bought that Emma Stone could be like pure evil. And I don't think the movie ever buys that either. It doesn't want Cruella to be pure evil, even though her name is Devil.
I think it seeks to humanize her, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does humanize her, and it makes this character interesting. But this character is very different to the one, you know, we see in the animation, which is completely fine. And I think Emma Stone is very good. I think the material she has isn't quite up to scratch for her, because she does give this great big performance. As I say, like when the two Emmas are up against each other, I think that's when it really, really hits it off. I don't think it'll be in an award contender, but I think it's still a fun performance from Emma Stone for sure.
It'll provide plenty of Halloween outfits, won't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I think she's terrific in it and really big and fun, and I had a great time with her, but it's not an awards performance, because for me, it just doesn't dig deep enough, which is not Emma Stone's fault. You know, that's the film. It doesn't want to do that. Whereas you look at Joaquin Phoenix as a Joker, you know, it's got everything in there. And, you know, you can feel he's done it for months and lost the weight and all the things the Academy like. And it's really transformative. And you watch it on the edge of your seat, kind of in a fetal ball, just like it's really a great performance, versus this is more sort of poppy.
Hmm. It does feel like it leaves it open for a sequel. Is it possible that we could join up the Cruella we get in the cartoons, who is pure evil, with this Cruella, who is kind of misunderstood and underdog? Is there possibly a sequel that would do that for you and get that arc going? Do you think that's something that would happen? I mean, obviously, if it makes enough money, it probably will, right?
Yeah, you can definitely see there's a gap there. There's still that bridge, like Jack said, that she's not pure evil yet. She's moving in that direction. She's gone from Estrella, who's a very nice young lady, into Cruella, who's definitely got a kind of brittle surface and is quite uncaring in some ways and is beginning to become the evil, but isn't there yet. So there's definitely room for the next one to sort of take it further and perhaps be, you know, a little bit darker. But it's all down, as we all know in Hollywood, it is all down to the finances. If this does really well, then I'm sure there will be one.
Are we going to be sending folk out to see this? Obviously, don't send Dalmatians out to see it. Although no dogs are harmed in this film. There are quite a few dogs in it, though, aren't there? Did you enjoy it as a dog fan?
Yeah, I always like to see a dog on screen. I'm happy with that.
Dog in an eye patch. What's not to love? Yeah. So we are recommending that you go out. It's half term coming up. Take the kids, have a ball, dress fabulously, do the Cruella thing. That is Cruella, which is out this Friday, the 28th. All right. So from monochrome madams to demonic possession, let's get the holy water. It's this.
This is Ed Warren here with Lorraine. All right, let's get started.
Residents of Brookfield were shocked this afternoon by the broad daylight murder of Bruno Sauls.
Court accepts the existence of God every time a witness swears to tell the truth. I think it's about time they accept the existence of the devil.
So this is The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. Just in case you were unclear of what The Conjuring series is, it is devilish. Jamie, what's the devil making people do in this one?
Well, it's based on a real life case from 1981, which Ed and Lorraine Warren were a part of. They did kind of investigate and gave evidence. And what happened is a teenager called Arnie Cheyenne Johnson, who in the film is played by Rory O'Connor, he killed someone. He basically killed his landlord And then his defense in court was, "The devil made me do it," that the defense lawyers claimed that it was demonic possession. And obviously, a court is going to kind of roll its eyes at that, skeptical jurors and a judge. So the Warrens were brought in and kind of investigated it. And in the film, it then flashes back. They spend their time investigating the 5 months before the killing of, like, you know, was he possessed? What's the evidence there? And they kind of bring their expert eye to it to try and put together a defense that will stand up in court, because they do believe he was possessed. Where it's a famous case is, I think it was the first case ever in American law where someone used this as a defense, where they said, "No, it wasn't me. I was under the spell of the devil. I was possessed."
So that sounds quite sort of a straightforward thing, but this is actually still got lots of, you know, arms clutching at you, dead people, blood. You know, you're still getting the things that you expect from the Conjuring world and universe. Yeah. Is it a good, jumpy, scary movie? Is it doing what they do really quite well and efficiently?
I think it starts and ends very well, but it starts with the exorcism of a young boy and it ends with another exorcism. And they're both really good and creepy and full out. Like, there's a couple of things in there where, with modern special effects, you know, they kind of goes beyond what The Exorcist did in 1973, as moments where you go, "Oh my God," you know, it's really horrifying. The middle section of the film, which is when they're kind of sifting through all the evidence and going back and trying to put together their case, I found it a little bit flat. It kind of lost me for that midsection. But where it is good visually, I mean, it's a new director this time. It's Michael Chase, who did Curse of La Llorona, which is actually one of the weakest films in the Conjuring universe, because there's been like 8 films now in the Conjuring universe. And even though that was weak, he stepped in here, taken over from James Wan, who's got a credit for the story and as producer. And he's very much done a James Wan, that it's still the Conjuring style, but it's all kind of muted colours and it's very elegant camera moves, and then suddenly punctuated by jump scares and, you know, a blare on the soundtrack, which James Wan does a lot as well in the first two Conjurings. So when you watch it, you can really see it's a Conjuring movie, even though it's not a haunted house movie. It is stepping out of that and doing something different, taking the franchise in a new direction. But for me, it's just not as good as the first two. They're sort of horror movies that they're mainstream and they use every trick in the book and they go for it hell for leather, but they're a lot of fun, you know, and they're a great Friday night out and get your popcorn and have a good scare. Whereas this one, it serves up moments like that and it's always watchable because you've got Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga playing the Warrens and they've got such great chemistry.
Yeah.
But like I said, that whole sort of midsection, for me, it lost me a bit. So for me, it's the weakest of the trilogy. Definitely.
Mm. Oh, I would disagree. I enjoyed it more because of that midsection.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I sort of liked the idea that it did something different and came out from sort of just a familial home, or, you know, sort of just a small thing. And it went on a larger stage where they're going to court and they're saying, "Look, if we accept that God exists, we have to accept the devil." And that being a, what do we all think about that? And now, what do we think about that? Is there such a thing? Can we quantify it? I liked that idea. And as you say, I love watching those two together because I think they've developed such a sort of rhythm together now that you just absolutely believe in them as that couple. And, you know, having watched Annabelle and the sort of side hustles from this and found them to be really quite derivative, I just thought this was doing something very elegantly. And I liked all the hat tips to The Exorcist. You mentioned that, but there are a couple of shots that are just, you know, framed, you know, when a figure is in front of a house that look exactly like something out of The Exorcist.
What I loved about that, just to butt in, is that famous shot from The Exorcist where Father Merrin arrives and he's silhouetted by a street lamp. They actually reverse it, that you, first of all, you see him arrive from inside the house looking down at him, and it's a wonderful reverse. And then it sort of cuts to outside the house and you get the replica of a famous shot. And yeah, that was a lot of fun.
I like that. Did you like it, Jack? As we've discussed earlier, you're not that keen on a scary movie. Did this do it for you?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm not keen on a scary movie. I enjoy a scary movie a lot, but I agree with Jamie. I think I enjoyed the exorcism at the beginning. I enjoyed the kind of more scary finale. I mean, some of the borderline action-centric mid stuff, you know, there's one bit where they kind of go superhuman and, you know, Lorraine's like hanging over a cliff and has to like grab her. I didn't do it for me at all. I mean, the whole running through a woods being scared sequence, is
I liked just, that.
It just didn't really work. Ed's kind of out of action.
Yes,
very
he
quickly
is. Yes.
Within the movie. Yeah. And I think during those parts without this central duo who really do hold it together, it really kind of fell a bit flat for me. And I wasn't sold on the character of Arnie, who is this person possessed by the devil. I mean, I thought it could have gone more interesting in like the court case. I thought there could have been more there and we could have gone a bit deeper. And it kind of touched on things on a surface level rather than kind of adding anything too interesting there. So yeah, I'm more in agreement with Jamie on this one.
We also get a little bit of their backstory, don't we? We get yes. sort of glimpses of how Ed and Lorraine met and sort of became boyfriend and girlfriend, which I thought, you know, it's always nice to see that, but it was handled in quite a cornball way. Mm. You know, just the way it was presented and the kind of dewy, honeyed light and everything. But like Jane said, they're such a great couple together and you really do believe they've been married for like 20 years and done all these yeah. cases. And this is why, even though I didn't love this Conjuring movie, I'd be perfectly happy to see a fourth and a fifth, because yeah. I want to see them do more cases. They're great. Yeah.
And I want to see Lorraine wear more ruffled blouses. She wears the hell yeah. out of them. So I think we are saying we recommend it, but you with slight reservation, me,
yeah.
I'm saying it's a good one. So that is also out at the cinema, the proper cinema this week. Go and have a little scare. Okay, it is now time to test film nerd powers with alternative line reading. Now, Jamie, you've done this excellently in the past.
Thank you.
In a terrifying fashion, it's time for Jack to test our powers with his alternative line reading of a film quote.
Why do I feel so nervous about it?
It's like Come an audition. It's like an audition. Come on.
We believe in you.
It's so obvious. Well, what about 11s or luncheon? Afternoon tea, dinner, supper. He knows about them, doesn't he?
Blimey.
I am stumped. That rings the faintest bell.
Doesn't really ring a bell with me. 11s. Who's chatting about 11s?
Just obvious for me.
Just obvious for you. So we've got to think, what does Jack like?
He's a big fan of the Angry Birds movies, Jack, isn't he? So it could be, is it Angry Birds 2? I know that's one of your favourites. No?
You're very close.
Oh, yeah. Is it animated?
It's not animated. You're so far off.
Really? Okay. If we're so far off, we're saying an animated movie, then I'm going to guess Cannibal Holocaust. No, you have to tell us.
That's from my favourite movie of all time, Lord of the Rings.
Oh, my God.
Oh, of course it is. Oh, my God.
I had
God.
Totally forgotten that you're a massive nerd about Lord of the Rings.
That is Pippin in The Fellowship of yeah. the Ring.
Of course it is.
What about 11s? Luncheon? Afternoon tea? You know, that one.
Yeah.
He's asking Aragorn.
Gentlemen, we do not stop till nightfall.
What about breakfast?
We've already had it.
We've had one, yes. What about second breakfast?
Don't think he knows about second breakfast, Pip.
What about 11s? Luncheon? Afternoon tea? Dinner? Supper? He knows about them, doesn't he?
I wouldn't count on it.
The ridiculous thing is that my wife and I actually sat down and rewatched the Lord of the Rings trilogy, extended versions, about 2 months ago. So it should be quite fresh in my mind. And I now mean, you've said
you
it, it's so obvious.
Jamie, you
didn't remember going to the cinema.
Cinema
a week ago. Exactly.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. So, I'm getting old.
And I would like to have a dispensation for not knowing that, because I hate the Lord of the Rings and have seen them only once a long time ago and tried to forget it ever since. So I think I'm allowed to not have got that. So shall we get all aboard a party bus with this?
So what made you decide to become a bus driver?
This and nude modeling are the two highest paying jobs on campus.
Dude, I think I'd pick the nude modeling.
So this is Drunk Bus. It debuted at South by Southwest. So what is the Drunk Bus, Jack? And actually, the lead character reminded me a little of you.
I don't think he reminded me of me at all. Charlie Tahan is this leading character. He's the actor who plays Michael. There's a former college kid who drives the drunk bus, which is basically the bus that does the loop around college, picking up drunk students and taking them home. Michael's slightly depressed after his girlfriend broke up with him and moved away. he gets into a fight while driving the drunk bus, and the company bring in a security guard named Pineapple, who's a very heavily tattooed fella who imparts some Samoan words of wisdom to Michael and kind of sets him free from the loop that he's been doing literally in his bus. And yeah, it kind of goes from there. The movie's set in 2006, and I kind of feel like it should have probably been released back in 2006. It feels more fitting with those kind of movies. I wasn't the biggest fan of this one, but I believe Jamie preferred it to me.
I did like it. I went in without high expectations, and I thought it was, you know, not great, not fantastic. I'm not going to say, like, you have to go and see this film, but I really enjoyed it for what it was, you know, that he's just doing this loop night after night on his bus, which obviously is a bit of a metaphor for his life, kind of playing it safe, stuck in a rut, just going round and round and round. And during the course of his journeys, you know, you have this supporting cast of characters who always pop up. Certain people always ride the bus. And then you also get lots of drunken antics that you've got all the college students, you know, in the back of the bus giving him grief and stuff. And what I really liked about it was just the relationship between the driver, Michael, and this Samoan bodyguard, Pineapple, who's played by Pineapple Tangaroo.
He's actually called Pineapple.
Yeah, Pineapple, isn't he? And all through the film, I was thinking, God, I recognise this guy. I'm sure I've seen him. And then I researched it afterwards, and he actually plays Michael Fassbender's bodyguard in Song to Song, the Terrence Malick.
Oh, is it him?
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay. That's it. He has fabulous earrings in this, doesn't he?
Fabulous earrings. And he is. He's a bit of a character in Austin, apparently, but he owns various body modification shops. Oh. And he is a sort of local celebrity. And yeah, there's one fantastic bit in this film where he suddenly pokes his tongue through a hole he's made, like in his chin, which really I wasn't expecting and sort of shocked me, just wiggling his tongue out. But yeah, I just thought they were a really sort of unique, odd couple, you know, that you always have this in movies. You have these sort of buddy movies or whatever, and they're so mismatched. You've got the, you know, a skinny driver and then this sort of big guy. And I just really like their chemistry and their relationship together. And I found the film kind of gently amusing, and yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I like this a lot more than you, Jack. And I think maybe it's because I've really felt like I'd been on that bus. I think it gave such a good sense of place. It's set in Ohio. I've never been to Ohio. I don't know what it's like, but I felt like I really did know that loop, having been on this bus off for this movie, and what that place was like and what it was like to drive that bus, and the sort of soul-destroying nature of it, with the frat boys constantly throwing eggs at you whenever you go past their house and all the rest of it. And I like this other character, like you said, Jamie. There's F.U. Bob, who is this guy in a wheelchair that brings a sort of pathos to the situation. There was a certain scene where they go to Bob's house and discover something about him. And you think, oh, we're going down this road and it's going to be the, you know, like a moment that is a epiphany for them. And then they see a painting that is very different to where that's leading. And it constantly does that. I felt like we were going through the tropes of films we've seen before, but constantly just veered off being exactly what you might expect. So I thought it was really inventive and warm and funny and sad and ultimately hopeful. I really quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, I really like Charlie Tahan as well, the lead character. Mm. People would probably know him. He played Wyatt in Ozark, and he played the Scarecrow in Gotham as well, just for a few episodes. But he's someone who's popped up in a lot of stuff the last few years, and I've not seen him sort of have a lead like this. And there's something about him I really like. So I enjoy spending time with him. Yeah, good. It's got my thumbs up.
My thumbs up too. Jack's on the fence. Ooh. Come on, come with us on the drunk bus.
I think Jamie summed it up as, like, I mean, you called it pleasant humor, and I didn't ever find it particularly, like, funny.
Yeah.
And it kind of went along. I liked Pineapple.
Not even when the man burped in his face or when they had the tongue piercing.
The tongue piercing was, it was fine.
God.
I mean, it was like, it was fine. I didn't mind it. I'm not the biggest person for this, like, American style type of almost twee humor. I was like, maybe had cracked a smile every so often, but I mean, I liked the relationship. I liked Pineapple a lot. I thought he was a really good character. I thought the stuff with, like, the girlfriend and that emotional arc was so overdone, and just, I didn't enjoy that at all. I found the lead character quite frustrating at times.
But I think that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah, but found it frustrating, like I'm done with this now. I don't know. I didn't.
Well, you've clearly never had your heart broken and been stuck in a rut trying to get out of it, thinking, how do I get over this? I think clearly you've just always had good luck with the ladies.
That is definitely because
I could totally recognize what he was going through. And that's, I think, what drew me to him.
Yeah, maybe I recognized him too much, where I was like, I've done this before. I'm over.
Yeah.
You just didn't.
Up your defenses.
Yeah, you didn't drive a bus, but everything else is true.
I've never encountered a drunk bus before. It's not something we had at our university, and I just wish we had. I spent the whole film thinking, God, this would be lovely, having this mode of transport to get you home. Because when I was that age and used to have to make my own way home, it used to sometimes take me hours sort of crawling through bushes. I was in such a state of falling asleep in the middle of roundabouts and stuff like that.
Well, this is a whole other movie.
A most unruly youth. So I wish I could have just slouched by a road and had a bus come along and sort of drag me onto it and get me home. That would have been quite nice.
I feel like my university time is shed. It's more akin to Jamie's than this drunk bus guy. So maybe that's it. I think I would definitely watch Jamie's time at uni. For sure. Oh, that sounds like a very interesting movie.
How did you go to a university and not have a bus? It doesn't, they're not necessarily like provided by the university, but there was always like the last bus out of the bus station that was rammed, and everyone on it was like worst for wear, or some poor sod who had that exam in the morning was come in from doing their shift wherever and was trying to read a book. And it was just like this horrendous mode of transport.
I went to university in a very small coastal town, so there was no need. I mean, basically everything shut at 10 p.m. anyway, and there was no need.
And you still managed to be crawling home and sleeping on roundabouts.
There was no public transport like that at all. The only time I ever got a bus is occasionally I'd go to a club in Exeter, which was the nearest sort of big city, and then they'd put on a minibus to get you home. So I had a few times where I fell asleep in the back of minibuses or on the floor or being shaken awake when we got there, but that's my only experience of it.
Well, I went to uni in Exeter, so there you go.
Hey, there you go.
So this pod has become the university and Exeter reunion. We'll take that offline, lads. I think we probably need to say, do we recommend people go see this film?
Yes, it's a good film. You enjoy it, is my take on it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'll probably be in the minority. I think most people will probably have a nice time with this.
That's Drunk Bus, which is out at cinemas on Friday the 28th. Will they be having a nice time with our next film then, which frankly left me in a state of panic? It's this.
Keep coming!
Just what you plan at. You know the rules, all right? You don't need me to explain it to you.
The machines took my card.
You have to contact to your bank.
What's going on in that head?
Say him out.
Hey.
Hey.
Hey. Hey.
So this is Surge. Jamie, you interviewed the star of this, Ben Whishaw. Tell us about this film, because this is quite the performance from him.
It really is. I think it's, I may even go as far as a career best performance, certainly up there for me. He plays Joseph, who is a mild-mannered security guard, well, airport security, you know, when you put your belongings, your cases and stuff through the conveyor belt on the airplane. And yeah, so he has this very sort of hemmed-in existence that he lives this kind of invisible life where no one even really notices him. He gets grief occasionally from customers, you know, putting their stuff through. He's browbeaten by his parents. There's one scene where we meet them and, you know, they're very strict and sort of talk down to him and stuff. And he's obviously just got a bit of a humdrum, dull life. And then one day, and this is what the film is, one day he just breaks out. And the film is set over 24 hours where he just does what the hell he wants, where he just sort of liberates himself and he just starts pacing around the streets of London and he's sort of grinning and gurning and grimacing. And, you know, you could think maybe he's having some sort of psychotic break or something. He just starts doing things like he starts robbing banks, anything he wants to do, anything he gets an impulse to do, he follows it. It's been described by some people as a kind of English Falling Down, which you can kind of see that. I would also compare it to films like Punch Drunk Love and Uncut Gems. And it's one of those
Uncut
films
Gems
where,
is the one it reminded me of, that suffocating atmosphere.
Exactly. It puts you right in the head of a protagonist who's got this sort of frenzied mindset and, you know, fireworks going off in his head. And
And Ben Whishaw is just incredible in this. He's on screen every second of it. They shot it on the real streets of London with hidden cameras a lot of the time, so the passers-by are real people with no idea. And he's pacing around and he's feeding off the energy of the streets, and buses are going by, you know, belching fumes, and you can really feel it. And it's incredible, especially watching it now after a year of lockdown where we're used to deserted streets now, to be in the middle of London, you know, choked, and him pacing around and sort of getting up to mischief. I just found it a really exhilarating experience. It's one of those films, it's very tense, it's quite tough to watch in some ways, but in another way, it's so liberating, because I think there is a thing where all of us have wanted at times to follow impulses and do things that aren't socially acceptable, whether it's, you know, the way we speak to people, whether you just want to say what the hell is really on your mind, or whether you've been in lockdown and followed all the rules and you just want to say, stuff it, I want to go out and do something mad. And I think even though we wouldn't maybe take it to the extremes that Joseph does and go and start robbing banks and stuff, I think you can really fantasize about it and live that illicit thrill of it. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think it's a cracking little movie. Really good. Mm.
Jack, did you relate to this one a little bit more?
Unsure. I mean,
can we not have, don't tell us stories about Exeter, but no. Did you like it?
Kind of.
Oh.
I thought Ben Whishaw was superb in it. I think he's a right gem of an actor, and he does give a really, really thrilling performance in this. Very unnerving. Watching him bite on glass made me wince so much. But I felt very let down by the final act of the movie, I would say. I think it did a really good job of building to something. I really enjoyed watching, I guess, you know, the surge, Ben Whishaw's character going through the motions and doing all these things and, you know, walking around the streets of London in this frenzied mood. But I feel like the payoff to it all was very disappointing for me. Didn't like where it went particularly. I felt like it should have done something, or there was something perhaps slightly more profound or something more interesting to say at the end. Like, I've watched the director, Anil Carrier. He's done like a short film with Ben Whishaw where it's similar energy but with kind of more music, and it's done to music, and I think it's called Beat. And he also did that short film, The Long Goodbye, with Riz Ahmed,
which is great,
which is really great. And I felt like this was almost in a very similar vein. You know, The Surge felt like a musical explosion in the same way as both those short films have kind of these big musical moments. This movie was just let down by the final act. It just didn't really come together for me. I don't want to go into spoilers, but, you know, I did find that the lasting taste of the movie was of a slight disappointment, and that it could have done with perhaps even just being a 20-minute film of maybe just The Surge.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, because it is very much like a sort of a weird frenetic jazz piece, isn't it? And I sort of didn't know where it was going to end up. So I didn't mind where it did, because I didn't have any real idea where it was going. And also I was quite just glad it was over. Like when you watch Hidden Gems, I wasn't ever enjoying it because it felt so frenetic and high wire and high tension. And I sort of had gritted teeth watching it, like I did watching Hidden Gems. And at the end of it, I was like, "Woo, that was exhilarating." But I'm not sure I loved it at the time, and I certainly don't think I'd want to watch it again. And I agree with Jamie. I think the performance by Whishaw is, you know, amazing. It's just all about him. And there's these lovely little side things with the parents. You know, at one point the mum says, "You chew or you swallow so loudly," and that's like her comment on her son. That's the only sort of thing that she can think to sort of connect with him on. So I loved all the aspects of it, but I don't think I loved the film.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, it's maybe not a film that you really enjoy. It's more a film you experience, that you're fully immersed in it, and it takes you on a mad ride, and a sort of scary ride, an alarming ride, a thrilling ride, all of these things. I mean, I think it depends a lot in your taste in films. That I like films that are intense and disturbing, as we all know. I think if you don't like that kind of thing, if you want to go to a cinema for a nice bit of escapism, or you want, you know, after a hard week at work, a fun Friday night, this isn't for you.
Yeah, this isn't escapism. This is like, as you say, the city crowding in on you, and like real life and gritty, grungy, mad rush of a big city, and being a nobody in a cog and all of that stuff, isn't it? It's not escapism at all.
No, it's not. Although I would say, like I said earlier, I do think it's got a sense of wild sort of wind in your hair liberation to it as well. That feeling of breaking free. I think anyone, like, you know, if you work in an office and you have to live by codes and, you know, your boss is telling you what to do, I think we all have that deep within us where you'd want to just say, you know, F you.
I'm not doing it anymore.
Mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore. So that side of it, I found really exhilarating.
I have a question. Did anyone watch it in the cinema?
No.
No, and I'd love to.
See, I think the sound design is probably great in a cinema.
My only comment would be that some of the camera movements, I was watching it on my TV, and some of the camera was quite dizzying, especially the bits when he's running through the streets and kind of you have that, the camera really goes all over the place and it's just like, oof, it's quite a lot. I imagine seeing it on the big screen, it would make it even more so.
It might be like kind of when you watch Blair Witch on the big screen. At some point, I had to close my eyes, not because I was scared, but because I felt like travel sick.
when it swings around
like that, it's quite discombobulating, isn't it?
It's all handheld camera and trying to keep up with Ben Whishaw as he sort of strides through London and does his thing. But I haven't seen it on the big screen yet, but it has played a few festivals before it's got this cinema release, and it's been really divisive. It's one of those films people either absolutely love or they don't like, which is fine. You know, I like films like that. I'd rather that than a film that's sort of okay and everyone thinks it's okay, 3 stars. You know, I like a film that you either get it or you don't, and it's fine either way.
So this is the punk AF that we probably hoped Cruella could be.
Yeah.
So we started with a 3-star film. What are we going to say this one is? I probably would say a 4.
Yeah, definite 4 for me.
And Jack's probably going to go lower.
I would go on 3.
Okay.
but I'm willing to say that, you know, I do think Ben Whishaw just elevates the whole thing so much. So just to see his performance is, you know, it's definitely one to go out and see for sure.
That's Surge, which is out in cinemas on Friday the 28th. And finally, it's time to move on to bovine matters with this.
It's the getting started that's the puzzle. No way for a poor man to start.
You have a cow?
First cow in the territory.
This ain't a place for cows.
Well, it's no place for white men either.
I sense opportunity here.
Good Lord, give me another.
I'll give you 6 ingots for that last one.
I taste London in this game.
We have to take what we can when the taking is good.
It seems dangerous.
So is anything worth doing?
That's First Cow. Jamie, where do we find this cow? Why is it the First Cow?
Well, it's because it's set in the 1820s in the Pacific Northwest, where Kelly Reichardt sets all of her films. It's a kind of Western in a way, although not a Western with big arid plains like we're used to. It's kind of more lush forests and stuff like that. But it is about a guy called Cookie, played by John Magaro, who is a cook, as you would expect, for some fur trappers. And he's not particularly happy with his life, and he kind of escapes the trappers and he teams up with a Chinese immigrant called King Lu, played by Orion Lee. And together they go off to kind of seek their fortune and seek their adventures. And this is where the First Cow comes into it, that the chief factor of the area, who's played by Toby Jones, who's this kind of stuffy Englishman, he has the first cow in the area imported over. So here he is with this lovely cow in his field that he's very proud of, so that he can have milk in his tea and coffee. And Cookie comes up with this grand scheme that if they can steal some milk from the cow every night, sneak into the field and get some milk, then he can make these amazing cakes, sort of almost like buttermilk scones in a way.
Yeah.
And
with
this
the
is
honey
what they
on
do.
Top.
Yes, yes.
Don't forget the honey on top.
And this is what they do. They sneak in every night, steal the milk, make these sort of scones, and everyone loves it. And they don't know what the secret ingredient is. And before you know it, they have queues down the street, you know, queuing up for their lovely scones they sell. So it's a story about sort of being an entrepreneur in a way and sort of the start of capitalist America. Like all of Kelly Reichardt's films, it's very, very slow burn, rhythmic, very small in scale, very, very intimate. But under that gentle surface really quite radical. You know, we're used to Westerns where it's stoic, square-jawed characters and men with no name and John Wayne and, you know, people really sort of laying down the law and bar fights and stuff. And this is a film about two very gentle, mild guys who form this deep companionship, deep friendship. And it's also a film about immigration in America that, again, with Westerns, we're used to having white people going from the east of the country, going out west to make their fortune, whereas this is not about that. This is about people pouring into America from other countries and sort of scrabbling to get by and that whole melting pot, that whole society. So there's a lot going on under the surface. Again, it won't be for everyone, like Kelly Reichardt's films aren't. She made Meek's Cut Off, Wendy and Lucy, Old Joy, you know, the Night Moves. They're very small, intimate films, but they're called slow cinema, you know.
Yeah, it's totally slow cinema, isn't it?
Yeah. And a lot of people won't like that. They find it, you know, really even tedious, like it takes its time. But if you go with the rhythms and you get lulled by it, which I do, I'm a big, big fan of her work. And I think this movie's wonderful. For me, you know, it's I'd go as far as say I love her debut, Old Joy, in 2006. And for me, this is her finest film since then. I really loved it.
Jack, is slow cinema for you?
Yes.
Oh. Hey, I didn't expect that.
I know, there's a pregnant pause and I didn't know whether we were going to be liking it or not. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I really like this one. In fairness, I wasn't the biggest fan of Meek's Cut Off, which I found that this movie had, you know, a lot of similarities, like pacing wise, cinematography wise, you know, it felt very, you know, akin to that. But I just really bought into this one. I thought the main character, Cookie, was just a very interesting person, you know, very innocent in this time of kind of barbaric people. Really, the group he's with at the beginning, he's so at odds with the rest of them, and then he forms this just incredibly unlikely relationship of people from completely different worlds. And I just really, really enjoyed it. I just completely bought into the tempo of it and the story as well. And I didn't enjoy the ending of Surge, but I loved the ending of this. I thought it just ended on such an incredible note that tied everything together, and I really loved it.
Yeah.
What do you think, Jane?
I wasn't expecting to like it, I have to say, because I wasn't a fan of Meek's Cut Off either. But I found this so mesmerizing. And as you say, you do have to adjust your pace immediately when you start. You know, it starts with this incredibly long shot of a boat just steaming down a modern day river. That takes ages. And you're like, what's... And then you're like, okay, no, I have to actually reframe how I'm going to watch this and like relax, breathe deeply, let it wash over me. And if you do that, it's just this lovely experience that is so visceral. I really felt like I was there on the frontier, and how it would smell and the constant mud and the sort of weird characters that were there, and the fact that they would go mental for this cake. There were so few luxuries. These men all like trapping beavers and doing their sort of stuff in the mud, that they would queue like children down this terrible muddy street to buy a cake that a man was sort of making with its secret ingredient. And yeah, as you say, there's so much to think about there. You know, it has the modern day openings to connect the past of America with its current state. You know, manifest destiny, this need to go west, entrepreneurism, capitalism, colonialism. I mean, there's all sorts going on here. But equally, if you don't want to think about any of that, it's just a lovely story about two guys who are like a sort of married couple, aren't they?
Yeah.
There's a love and a respect and a romance going on there that's not, you know, a sexual thing, but just this deep sort of respect for each other and working together really, really well, that was so delightful. And also just the way Cookie talked to the cow, I found extremely soothing. His chats with this lovely cow, and he just talked to her very gently to get the milk out of her. It's an absolute delight. The only thing I would say is I felt like I wanted one of those cakes to eat whilst I was watching it, because I did I want to taste that. What does that taste like with the honey on top? I really want it. And the shaved cinnamon that he very carefully shaved. Honestly, you need a cake in hand, I think, whilst watching this.
Kelly Reichardt kind of gave John Magaro cookery books from the time. And he went off and sort of read them, and he was cooking all of this at home. He was only cooking stews and kind of the food of the period for his wife at home.
Oh, God, I bet she didn't love that.
He got sick to death of it, apparently. And he made these cakes, and, you know, he became a bit of an expert at making these cakes. But You mentioned the cow earlier, which how can you not with First Cow? And she is just a delight. She is played by a two-year-old Jersey cow called Evie.
Jamie.
We got to go into this. And the cast and crew were very respectful of her. They had to learn to film very slowly around her and not, you know what film crews are normally like, clattering around, getting on with their job. They had to sort of walk on tiptoes and whisper and really treat her with respect. And she got to like everyone. And apparently she really did form a great relationship with John McGarrow, that whenever he used to approach her, she loved it. He used to go up and nuzzle him and he used to whisper to her. And you can really see it. And I'm very happy to say that this cow now has got a little calf and she's living a wonderful life on a farm and she's not in some slaughterhouse. And she's done her bit. She's a film star and now she's retired in happiness and bliss.
What a lovely story. So I think we can all agree that this film is just all round lovely.
It's my film of the week, and there's some good films this week, like Surge, but this is my film of the week.
Okay, so it's Jamie's film of the week, and it's out this weekend on Mubi. Jack, what's your film of the week?
Yeah, it's definitely First Cow as well.
I might actually go Cruella, just because when I was having fun with it, I was having great fun. So that might be mine. Before we go, we've got time for a reader's question. So what was your plan B for a job if you weren't a film journalist? Jamie, is it milking cows?
It's not. I mean, I've got two plan Bs. Number one, well, this is plan B, is I was an extra in Shaun of the Dead. And I just can't believe that basically Edgar didn't then cast me as Nick Angel in Hot Fuzz. Honestly, it was magnetic on the screen. And every time I watch that film back, all I can see is myself in that scene as a zombie in the corner of the screen.
So I think was a movie star, right?
Yeah, I've got presents. So I think I could have been a movie star with a lucky break. I was very unlucky there. But on a more serious note, my plan B would be to be a magician, because growing up, I was really into magic. And as a teenager, I used to make a lot of sort of side money as a children's magician, used to do shows and used to enjoy it. Found it very entertaining.
But doesn't do any shows for us, even though we ask. I mean, that's...
I've done card tricks for you, Jane. I've done card tricks.
And won't tell us how they carve up ladies and do anything. He won't.
No, I won't tell you anything.
Because the magic circle will have you out.
If you've ever got any parties, you need a sort of film critic / magician, you know where to go.
Okay. Cinematic magician. Jack, what magic have you got up your sleeve?
I don't think I ever had a plan B. I didn't even have a plan A. So, you know, we just kind of landed where I landed somehow. It was all very quick and very fun, and I'm very glad to be here, obviously. But if I was going to be anything else, it would probably be a rock star, probably a musician in a band. I played and sang and did guitar. So, yeah, that would probably be plan B, really.
I like that you're both aiming high here. I mean, my dream job when I was little is I thought there was somebody that named all the roads. So they'd go around, and then whenever they built a new road, they'd go, you know, bring out the namer. And I'd turn up and I'd look at the road and I'd go, ooh, I think this is Green Street. And they go, right, put that on the sign. That's what I wanted to do, and then discovered it wasn't a job. So that was...
Go up to the road. Where does this one lead? Oh, this one goes to Bristol. All right, Bristol Street then. Go on then.
Yeah. I think it's a great job.
What would you do now, though?
I have no idea, because I've done this for so long. I know not how to do anything else. I'd want to still work in film in some capacity, I think, so... Hopefully I would. But maybe I could be your assistant, Jamie, if you're a film star.
If I ever become A-list, yeah.
Okay, definitely. I'll get your coffee.
You can ride my coattails to the top of the A-list tree.
Marvellous. Okay, so don't forget that the latest issue of Total Film is out now, with Loki on the cover, the god of mischief himself. It is in shops on Friday. But for now, I think we should probably just leave it there and say goodbye. Go and milk a cow somewhere or eat a cake. So say goodbye, boys.
Goodbye, boys.
No.
You keep saying you got something for me, something you call love, but confess, you've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.